skin got assassin eyes. I'm looking up into the sapphire sky. A well-dressed man waiting on the last plane. Standing in the gallows with my head in a noose. Any minute now I'm expecting all hell to break loose. Crazy and time is strange. Locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. This place ain't do me any good. I'm in the wrong town, should be in Hollywood. Just a second there I thought I saw something. Gonna take dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcuts, gonna dress in drag. Only a fool in here thinks he's got anything to prove. Lot of water under the bridge, lot of other stuff too. Don't get up, gentlemen, I'm only passing through. People are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, my brain. Used to care, but things have changed. I've been walking 40 miles of bad road. The Bible is right, the world will explode. I've been trying to get as far away from myself as I can. Some days are too hard to touch. The human mind can only stand so much. You can't win with a losing hand. Feel like falling in love with the first woman I meet. Putting her in a wheelbarrow and wheeling her down the street. People are crazy and times are strange. Locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. I just don't show it. You can hurt someone not even know it. The next 60 seconds could be an eternity. Gonna get low down, gonna fly high. All the truth in the world adds up to one big lie. I'm in love with a woman who don't even appeal to me. Mr. Jinx and Miss Lucy, they jumped in late. I'm not that eager to make that mistake. Some people are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.
Well, here we are, ladies and gentlemen. What a difference 24 hours can make. This mic down here in Arizona land, today is the 16th of July, 2018. It's a Monday. Your mind is your primary weapon. You're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. It's about 5 minutes after.
I'm a four-year-old.
It's about 5 minutes after 8 a.m. Arizona time. We'll continue our study here about wars of national liberation, the Irish Troubles, and the role of the black and tans, terrorism, rebellion in North Africa. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today. Have some border news. If you'd like to call in, the telephone is 712-432-0900. And then the mechanical voice will come in, ask you for the room number, and that's 957-464 and the pound sign. And then you can push star 6 to unmute your phone. 712-432-0900. And the room number is 957-464. The pound sign, and then star 6 to unmute your phone. As always, we send this broadcast out to Lily Grace Antoinette. And there was also something I heard on the local AM this morning referring to the Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. As over the weekend, in 21 different newspapers in 12 different states, there were letters to the editor, and they were all signed by different people. The only problem is all the letters were identical, a form letter. People have already started to speculate if George Schwartz is behind the letter-writing campaign. But, you know, as usual. Now, I did hear Mark Kornke mention on the Intel report, I think it was Friday evenings, afternoons, there was a letter by Chuck Baldwin and pointing out the might be a little bit cautious about this Brett Kavanaugh of about that the previous Republican nominees, I think there was one from, was it Ronald Reagan or maybe somewhere before that, that had given us Roe versus Wade. And then there was another Republican nominee, who's the Roberts, that he had flip-flopped on the Obamacare. So not to necessarily get your hopes up thinking that somehow just because it's a Republican making the nomination doesn't mean that it's as hunky-dory as we would wish it to be. But I do kind of question about this letter-writing campaign. 21 newspapers in 12 different states, all signed by different people, but it's word for word the same letter. There's also an event coming up. It's a ways away, and there most likely would only apply to people that are living here in Arizona, or if you would see that it was worthwhile. It's a dinner invitation honoring Arizona's Vietnam veterans. It'll be the 8th annual commemoration of the Vietnam War, or honoring Arizona's Vietnam era, and Vietnamese veterans and their families. The keynote speaker is going to be Professor Dr. Mark Moyer, who is the senior advisor at the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. He served previously as the director of the Project on Military and Diplomatic History at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and a member of the Hoover Institution Working Group on the Role of Military History in Contemporary Conflict. Also is going to be Colonel Joey Strickland, U.S. Army retired, former director of Arizona Department of Veteran Services, co-founder of the Arizona Vietnam commemoration events, and director of the Louisiana Department of Veterans Services. It's going to be the 20th of October Check-in is at 4 p.m. The seating's at 5 p.m. and the event is going to start at 5:30. It's going to be at the Embassy Suites by Hilton Scottsdale Resort, 5001 North Scottsdale Road, a business casual or class A or service equivalent with military decorations. It's $50 a person, and that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. So it's an interesting event. They had the ones here at the Auction Casino last year. Dr. Moyer was there. Quite interesting, especially considering the difficulty he has in, it has to do with a lot of these universities have their faculty and a bunch of throwbacks from the anti-war Vietnam stuff. And Dr. Moyer is he's a little bit younger and can't seem to get into any of these teaching staffs because he has what they've referred to as a revisionist history of truly examining the events surrounding the Vietnam War and dispelling a lot of this communist propaganda that we've been spoon-fed for 50 years. Also, I had mentioned the other day about the new book by Max Boot called The War, or The Road Not Taken, about Colonel Major General Lansdale. And the book in there, about the center of the book, specifically mentions Dr. Moyer and one other person that I'm not familiar with as dispelling these misconceptions that have been around, Sheehan and the Bright Shining Lie, and who's the other one? A couple of these people that were reporters and then came back from Vietnam and then wrote books and became big celebrities and all that, part of that. So anyway, I'm going to make an attempt this year to Dr. Moyer on Your Mind is Your Primary Weapon and discuss a little bit about insurgency. He's written several books about Vietnam, and more recently I think there was one called The Crisis of Command having to do about Iraq and Afghanistan in a more modern setting of insurgency. Anyway, so we'll do that. I'm not sure if it'll be up here on Liberty Tree Radio or on our Thursday, Friday broadcast on the Micro Effect. Might have a little bit of spare time. Also, working on a couple other people. I have a friend of mine is a helicopter pilot in Vietnam in the 1st Air Cav, and also somebody that was an intelligence analyst from Vietnam, a couple other people too that have expressed a desire also work on somebody else that was in Vietnam that was eventually retired as a major and went on in a successful medical career and is a special forces ranger, recondo, nutrang. So interesting aspects of what he had done. It was kind of an interesting story, but I know we pressed for time, so I can't dwell on it too long. But I guess the CO of they were running a radar installation and had noticed that these, what appeared to be in the radar return, Soviet helicopters coming in across the border and landed inside of Vietnam. And they knew the grid coordinates, and they were in contact with an 8-inch artillery. Do you see it coming? 8-inch artillery unit. And the CO told him that, don't do anything, that I wouldn't do while he was gone. And there was also a great big to-do about international incidents and things like that. But the next time there, over the weekend, while the CO was gone, they got these radar returns of these Soviet helicopters flying into Vietnam. And so they contacted the 8-inch artillery and scattered a few rounds in that direction. And they put out a recon team and found wreckage of helicopters of where they had been firing these. And needless to say, the helicopter activity dropped off to zero. And, of course, when the CO came back, the defecation hit the oscillation and don't do that again, and you don't know what is going on, and we just can't risk having a problem like this. So just some things like that of perspectives and maybe trying to reexamine. I know that it's not going to do anything to bring anybody back alive or, how should we say, set the record straight. But, you know, after 50 years or more of being spoon-fed lies, it's about time that these people get the, I'm not sure what word. I have four or five of them running around. The credit that what they had done instead of the way that some of them were treated when they came back here stateside, the land of the big TX. But anyway, those are just some of the things that are looming down the road, and I'm working on them as we speak. So about the wars of national liberation and their cost, and the Irish troubles, and the role of the black and tans, terrorism in Israel, and rebellion in North Africa. Because the price of national liberation can come high, as well with the toll of the two wars in Vietnam bears witness. But yet in general, it can be said that modern wars of national liberation and those of the remaining colonies and those of the semi-colonies such as Cuba have been remarkably economical of human life as compared with wars between equal states and alliances of states. But the actual battle casualties in Cuba, for example, could not have exceeded a few hundred killed during 2 years of civil strife. Revolutionary sources, immediately after Batista's fall, it claimed some 20,000 dead as the seven-year toll of police terror under the dictatorship. No listing or other attempt at verification has ever been published, nor have the battle casualties ever been totaled. And accounts of the individual battles by Guevara and others, however, indicate a very moderate final figure. And Zanzibar, recently, the toll probably was closer to a few dozen. In Cyprus, it did not go over three figures, and the same is true for Israel, if one counts only the period of hostilities between the Jews and the British, and not the Arab-Israeli wars that followed. And in Ireland, writes Richard Bennett, quote, the IRA in its first year of war against England had killed at least 26 people, 18 of them policemen, and had fired shots in anger at human targets on not much more than 100 occasions, end quote. And no government could capitulate to such a threat. Now, the fact is that England did capitulate, if not the threat per se, then to the intolerable political and economic situation that the war to produce given another year. Now, here is yet another illustration of the nature of the war of the flea, of which the guerrilla tactics in one aspect and terrorism, urban guerrillaism, is another. Bombs and bullets are the physical weapons of the rural guerrilla and equally of the urban terrorists, but the real lever for both is politics. Divisions may be destroyed, as in Vietnam, but this is not the ultimate objectives. Cities may be terrorized, as in Cyprus, but again, this is not the goal, the purpose of the war of national liberation, pitting the feeble resources of a small and primitive nation against the strength of a great, industrial power is not to conquer or to terrorize, but to create an intolerable situation for the occupying power or its puppet government. Now, in the War of the Flea, paramilitary cannonades wreak more havoc than artillery. Headlines burst bigger than bombs. Peace marches win battles where machine guns fail. And casualties are low because guerrillas, while fighting campaigns of attrition, shun the battles of attrition common to the regular armies. And terrorism, conventionally viewed with pious horror as political murder, but not more murderous than blockbusting a city or napalming in a village, is far more humane, being more selective than most other types of warfare. And in the end, the oppressive power relinquishes its grasp, not because its armies have been defeated in battle, but because the satellite, the rebellious colony, through terrorism and guerrilla warfare becomes one, too great a political embarrassment to be sustained domestically or on the world stage, and two, unprofitable, too expensive, or no longer prestigious. The rebel casts himself in the role of David, and it makes it his business to force the enemy into the role of Goliath in the public mind. His every act and announcement, a play on the sympathies and the sense of justice of the global witnesses of the struggle. And they do that by creating the picture of a courageous people fighting for independence against the monstrous forces of tyranny and oppression. And also at the same time, the entire arsenal of revolution, guerrilla fighting, terror, sabotage, propaganda, is brought to bear in an effort to take the profit out of colonialism by demoralizing labor and impeding production, boycotting imports, inciting insurrection, forbidding payment of rents to foreign owners, wrecking foreign industrial installations, and in everywhere increasing the cost of exploitation and of political control. And the expense of maintaining the bureaucracy and the police and the military forces that must be used to put down the rebellion. Now, if the goal is clearly understood and the revolutionary tactics are resolutely applied, the colonial power quickly becomes involved in a struggle that simultaneously blackens it before the world and inflicts financial losses that will soon be translated at home into political liabilities. And the very efforts of a colonial power to end the struggle will only accelerate the process. And for the more stringent the methods of suppression applied, the greater the hatred of the colonial population for the colonializers or for the satellite people of the imperialists, and the harsher the picture of oppression is to be held up before the world. Now, the world includes the population of the oppressor nation, and more particularly, the government's domestic political opposition, which will be sure to raise a hue and cry about the message used to put down the rebellion, as well as the burden on the taxpayers, the loss of national prestige, etc., etc. Now, excellent examples. This entire process may be drawn from the experiences of two great empire builders at the last century, Britain and France. For the former, the struggle that led to the independence of Cyprus was almost blow for blow a repetition of the troubles that had freed Catholic Ireland from the English rule more than three decades earlier. And the lessons of Ireland were also applied in Israel. Leaders of the Irgun and the Stern Group studied the writings of the Irish Republican Army commanders, the better to know their enemy and to the means by which he could be driven out of Palestine or, if not driven out, forced to end a situation that terror made politically and financially intolerable. All the purpose of terror, said Lenin, is to terrify. He might have strengthen the observation while weakening the amorphism by remarking that its greater purpose is to sabotage the orderly administration of government by forcing those who govern into a defensive position in which nothing can be accomplished without the continual crippling presence of an armed guard. And its secondary effect, if not its purpose, is to induce a counterterrorism that serves the rebel cause better than any stratagem the rebels themselves could devise. And this was the case in Ireland, where, despite a long history of insurrection, public support of the independence movement was lukewarm until fired by the acts of the British themselves, in particular by the depredation of the notorious Black and Tans, recruited to strengthen the Royal Irish Constabulary. And of the ill-starred Easter Rebellion raised by Irish nationalists in 1916, 4 years before the Tans were heard of, Richard Bennett writes in The Black and Tans, "The Eastern Rebellion was a sadly mismanaged enterprise. The rebels proclaimed the Republic, occupied a number of buildings in Dublin, and held out bravely for a week. A young mathematics teacher called Davila was the last to surrender, and there was little trouble in the rest of Ireland. The Irish people declined the nobly worded invitation to prove itself worthy of the august destiny to which it is called, and looting Dubliners made hay while the shells crashed and the bullets flew. Never in the history of Ireland had a rebellion inspired so little sympathy. There were nearly 100,000 Catholic Irishmen fighting with the British Army, and the rebellion seemed as much a stab in the back to the majority of the Irish people as it did to the English. The prisoners, who were marched through the streets, passed between lines of angry, jeering Dubliners. The cause of Irish independence seemed lost or postponed to some far distant date." Now, at this point, the British made a fatal mistake. They proceeded to shoot 15 leaders of the Easter Rebellion. The executions caused the scandal that spread around the world and ended any hope of a peaceful solution to the Irish question. The fortunes of the almost discredited Sinn Féin independence movement, provided with a set of holy martyrs, quickly revived. But London went ahead, almost as if deliberately inviting its own defeat by preparing a conscription act. The Great War in Europe was then in progress, and the manpower was desperately needed to draft Irish men of military age. The measure united the country against the crowd and sent thousands of young men into the Irish militia known as the National Volunteers, soon to be converted into the Revolutionary Irish Republican Army. England could not have done more to set the stage for the troubles to come. On January 21st, 1919, the Dáil Éireann Legislative Assembly of the Sinn Féin Party declared its independence from Britain and proceeded to constitute itself de facto republican government on Irish soil, soon to be complete even to Sinn Féin courts and police. The maneuver was political in intent. Actual war was not envisioned. Yet the intention of the Dáil was one thing and the temper of the volunteers another. Scarcely had the Declaration of Independence been signed when the first shots of the revolution were fired. On the very same day, a group of volunteers ambushed a party transporting gelatinite to a quarry and killed two members of the Royal Irish Constabulary. Scattered, more or less spontaneous clashes between the police and the volunteers soon gave way to an organized campaign of raids and ambushes under the direction of Michael Collins in Dublin, of the IRA brigade commanders elsewhere. And the actual casualties were relatively few, but the effects were remarkable. Helmeted soldiers patrolled the streets of Dublin with fixed bayonets as in a foreign capital under wartime occupation. The docks were piled high with war materiel, and every delivery of arms or military supplies moved over the roads required an escort of armed cars and tenders filled with troops for fear of the IRA. Hundreds of political prisoners crowded the jails, and the Crown forces were kept so busy with searches for arms and IRA suspects that more than 20,000 house raids were recorded between January of 1919 and March of 1920. Now, by the end of 1919, a bitter struggle was in progress that exempted no one, military or civilian. The country had become an armed camp in which assassinations and raids on military barracks were daily occurrences. In Dublin, the atmosphere was such that nearly every important British official connected with the Dublin Castle Administration was virtually interned in the castle, and conditions for the soldiers and the police in their barracks were not much better. There was little action, but there was no lull in the atmosphere of suspense. Any road might lead to an ambush. The most harmless-looking civilian might suddenly draw a gun and fire. Scarcely a day passed that failed to provide the headline-making Irish incident for the avid British press. Abroad, thanks to Eamon de Valar's highly effective propaganda campaign against the Irish immigrants in America, sympathy for the rebel cause reached such dimension that the British envoy to Washington reported himself to be almost powerless for good owing to the universal sentiment in favor of Ireland. 43,000 British troops occupied Ireland, in addition to the 10,000-man Royal Irish Constabulary, soon to be augmented by several thousand black and tans, whose nickname derived from their mixed uniform of military khakis and RIC black Sam Brown belts, holsters, boots, and cap visors, who later joined by some 1,500 temporary cadets of the RIC Auxiliary for controlling the 26,000 square miles of insurgent Southern Ireland. It was scarcely sufficient. The terrain was ideal for guerrilla fighting. The green, rugged, and in many places virtually roadless countryside being impassable to motor transport during the wet weather, which seemed to be almost most of the time the IRA men on the run, as the Irish expression had it, found perfect sanctuary in the bogs and the wooded mountains, yet were always close enough to towns and main arteries to launch lightning raids under cover of the darkness and quickly withdraw. Now, in the cities, the gunmen of the IRA were so well integrated with the populace at large that most of them held regular civilian employment. And the majority of the IRA operations in Dublin and Cork were scheduled at night for that reason. There was insufficient manpower available during daylight hours. The IRA actions consisted for the greater part of armed raids on military barracks, ambushes of military convoys in the countryside, and attacks on small patrols or individual IRC men and soldiers in the cities. And in addition, there was a special squad in Dublin that specialized in the assassination of British intelligence agents and political figures. From the military point of view, much of the activity had only a nuanced value. Newspaper ink flowed more freely than blood. IRA gunmen missed more often than hit their targets. The barracks that burned were often enemy, and the destruction only symbolic. Often, too, the raiders were repulsed, having expended more ammunition than they had hoped to capture. And the victims of the gunmen were more frequently Irish than English, and suspected informers, collaborators, and the like. The IRA was not, however, fighting a military war. It was fighting a political war, and the true effects of the terrorism were psychological and political. And the enlistments in the IRC stopped and resignations mounted as the morale sagged, and the troops in their quarters, foreigners in a hostile country, lived under a strain which veterans of the war in Europe said was greater than that of the trenches. How at one time, the fear of the IRA gunman and any casual stroller might be a gunman reached such intensity that a military order that was posted warning civilians that any man walking with his hands in his pockets was liable to be shot on sight. The pockets could conceal pistols, and the British were taking no chances. Now, the raids on the barracks and the convoys may have been ineffective militarily, but they had their effect on the economy and the orderly administration of a country being systematically plunged into chaos. The mere chance of a raid or an ambush anywhere at any time slowed transport, restricted production, and forced the military to stay constantly on alert, to guard all barracks, all convoys, all public buildings, to travel only in strength, to continually screen civilians, check credentials, search buildings, to interfere with traffic and with all of the multifarious activities of everyday life. And that was at a tremendous cost to the government, to the war-weary British taxpayers, to the British owner of the Irish properties, to investors, the bankers, and all who had a stake in an orderly, productive Ireland. And each incident was another damaging blow to the British prestige abroad, which shook British morale at home, and each was sure to be seized upon by the Labour Party and the Liberals as fresh ammunition to be hurled at the Conservative government. If the military could stand the strain, Downing Street could not. Unpredictably, and efforts to control the situation only worsened it. The Black and Tans, arriving early in 1920, were a godsend to the IRA. For every incident the latter produced, the former produced another, where the actions of the IRA could be admired abroad as part of a courageous struggle for liberty. The reprisals of the Tans could only draw blame and further unite the Irish in opposition to the Crown. And the Irish propagandists made the most of oppression so that the burning of a few shops and homes became magnified in the rape of the entire villages and the summary executions of a relatively handful of Sinn Feiners or suspected IRA men became indiscriminate slaughter on a major scale. And when a divisional commander of the RIC told his men to shoot first, ask questions later, the clandestine Irish Bulletin quoted him as having said, quote, "If a police barracks is burned, or if the barracks already occupied is not suitable, then the best house in the locality is to be commandeered, the occupants thrown into the gutter. Let them die there. The more, the merrier. Police and military will patrol the country at least 5 nights a week. They are not to confine themselves to the main roads, but make across the country, lie in ambush, and when civilians are seen approaching, shout, hands up. Should the order not be immediately obeyed, shoot, and shoot with effect. If persons approaching carry their hands in their pockets or in any way suspicious looking, shoot them down. You may make mistakes occasionally, and innocent people may be shot, but that cannot be helped, and you are bound to get the right parties sometime. The more you shoot, the better. I will like you, and I assure you no policeman will get in trouble for shooting any man." End quote. Now, the report was duly denied, but it made little difference. It may as well have been true. There was sufficient truth in it to make it credible, and that was what counted. It was all of a piece with accounts that told of lorry loads of black and tans roaring through village streets, firing their rifles at random, at the peril of anyone who happened to be in the way, and singing, "We are the boys of the RIC, as happy can be." Now, whether the Tans actually sang such a ditty on their forays into the is of little importance, but what was important was the reputation that they created for themselves and the effects of it. Singing or not singing, they did sufficient irresponsible killing, burning, dynamiting of houses, and drunken pillaging to create a scandal in England, and the scandal aided the Irish cause. The Daily News of London virtually accused the government of secretly conniving at the barbarous reprisals now being systematically carried out, and the Conservative Times declared, "Day by day, the tidings from Ireland grow worse. The accounts of arson and destruction must fill English readers with a sense of shame. The name of England is being sullied throughout the empire and throughout the world by this savagery for which the government can no longer escape, however much they may seek to disclaim responsibility." End quote. Now, where the counterterrorism, the Tans and the auxiliaries shocked the British public, the martyrdom of various Irish heroes, Terence McSweeney, Lord Mayor of Cork, who died in Brixton Gaol after a hunger strike lasting 70 days, young Kevin Barry, hanged in Dublin for killing a British soldier, captured the sympathy of millions of loyal Britons. The IRA never gained sufficient strength to defeat the British military forces in any engagement of any size, anywhere, at any time. Although the British Viceroy, Lord French, estimated it as some 100,000 strong, and the British Secretary for Ireland doubled the estimate, reporting as many as 200,000 ready to murder by day and night. Its peak strength on paper was never more than 15,000 men, and Michael Collins later put the effective fighting strength of the IRA at 3,000. But then, as noted before, the British Rebellion was a political rather than a military contest, and the truce that ended it late in 1921 brought a political victory that obviated the need of a military decision. For the political victory, 3,000 armed men were enough. The role was more than a catalyst than agent. Their militancy had accomplished two things. It had transformed an apathetic population into one actively hostile to British rule, and so creating a massive resistance that the English could not economically or, in terms of politics, practically overcome. And it had included a counterterrorism which, again, for political reasons, defeated its own purpose. Now, if at the end of some centuries of sporadic struggle against foreign domination, the Irish failed to hurl the English invader into the sea, they accomplished something better and more economically. By their resistance, they took the profit out of colonialism and turned the colony from a British asset into a liability, so in effect persuading the enemy to withdraw. Now, there's nothing very novel about the means employed by the terrorists. They were such as ordinary ingenuity might suggest. Fires were set in public buildings. Irish flags were flown with grenades attached to the lanyards to booby-trap the soldiers who came to remove them. Slats were removed from the roofs of police stations, and gasoline was poured into the attics to be set afire. Bridges were blown up and rails removed from the railroad tracks. Sugar was put into gasoline tanks, sand in crankcases, emery dust in machinery gears. The means of sabotage and of armed aggression were simple, and the actual damage relatively unimportant. But what was important was, one, the cost of suppressing such a campaign, and two, the political effects on both the Irish and the English people, and the only being unified and forced into an active involvement, and the other divided and rendered impotent by the same effort and its consequences. Now, could the British have won in Ireland by putting a huge army into the field and waging a Cromwellian war of extermination to suppress the rebellion? Now, in the 20th century, the question is meaningless. British public opinion, related always to economic considerations, would not have permitted such a solution, even had it been considered. A generation later, would world opinion forbid any similar approach to the problem of Palestine, the problem of Cyprus, the problem, for that matter, of Suez, where the abortive Anglo-French invasion of 1956 produced global repercussions? Draconian solutions are possible only in isolation, in an indifferent world, and even then only against a population that has not the will to resist. Now, in Palestine, for example, the British were able to wage a vigorous campaign against the so-called dissident political faction, the Irgun Zun Lumi, and the smaller Lome Harut Israel, the Lehi, or the Stern Group, only for so long as the Jewish Agency and other conservative Jewish elements in Palestine and abroad turned their faces against violence. The stiffening of Jewish resistance in reaction to the suppression campaign and the continued British restrictions on immigration, and at last the entrance of the Haganah into the struggle in 1945, confronted the British with a choice that was no choice. They could declare on the entire Jewish nation or surrender the Palestine Mandate. And they wisely chose to surrender the mandate and leave the question of the future Jewish state to the United Nations. Contemporary historians, even Jewish historians, have tended to deprecate the role of the Irgun, and even more than that of the Sternists, in the struggle for Israel's independence. But yet it seems clear that their contributions was vital. It was to create an open struggle without which there could have been no resolution of the issue, or without which the British withdrawal might have been postponed indefinitely. The terrorists had no illusions about their ability to free Israel by their own efforts. The Irgun numbered no more than 2,000 fighting men, and the Lehi never had more than 400. And their purpose, rather, was to demonstrate to the British the immense cost in money and manpower of continuing to rule in the face of determined resistance, and to arouse the people until the people were united in opposition to the foreigner. And lacking weapons and manpower and the capacity for important sabotage or large-scale guerrilla warfare, the Lehi chose the tactics most suitable to its means, individual terrorism. On November 6, 1944, the campaign reached out to Cairo to strike down Lord Moyne, the British Minister of State in the Middle East. The deed, as Gerald Frank called it in his illuminating study of the assassination, shocked the British and horrified conservative people everywhere. The two young terrorists who had killed Lord Moyne, subsequently hanged for their act, were universally reviled, as Frank relates. The Hebrew press could not find words strong enough to denounce the deed. It was an abomination. But since Zionism began, lamented Haaretz, the most influential newspaper in the country, no more grievous blow has been struck at our cause. The Jewish Agency expressed its horror at this revolting crime. In London, Dr. Chaim Weizmann said this shock had been far more severe and numbing than that of the death of my own son, end quote. A shock, certainly, but that had been the intention, and those who feared for that cause of Israel's independence were mistaken. And by the end of another year, the quickening cycle of violence and repression had created sufficient shocks to arouse the Jewish people and to convince the British that they were engaged in a hopeless task, a contest that they could not hope to win, but could only to prolong and intensify. And as Gerald Frank wrote in The Deed, certainly the independence for which the two terrorists were hanged in 1945 would not have won in 1948 without decades of political activity in England, in Europe, in the United States, in Palestine and elsewhere, without the immigration and colonialization and labors of hundreds of thousands, without, in the end, a determined citizenry, a resourceful army, and an indomitable leadership. Nor without all those would that independence have been maintained in the years that followed. But there is no doubt that the deed was one of the greatest irritations, the great harassment, which so annoyed and confused and bedeviled the British that ultimately they gave the problem over to the United States nations, and thus opened the door to the partition of Palestine and the first Jewish state in 2,000 years. Now, there's a point to be made here. If revolution is to be understood as a historical, social process rather than an accident or a plot, then it will not do to consider guerrillas, terrorists, political assassinations as deviants or agents somehow apart from the social fabric, irrelevant or only fortuitously relevant to the historical process. Guerrillas are of the people, or they cannot survive, cannot even come into being. Terrorists and terrorism, while it arouses the populist will to revolt, is at the same time a manifestation of that will, expressing the first stiffening of popular resistance to establish authority, the first surge of the popular impulse towards a new and different order of existence. Now, it may be argued that terroristic movements attract criminals and psychopaths. So they do. But criminality itself is a form of unconscious social protest, reflecting the distortions of an imperfect society. And in a revolutionary situation, the criminal, the psychopath, may become as good a revolutionary as the idealist. Now, in Palestine, those who directed the terror were not adventurers, but a vanguard. In their actions, they expressed the long-suppressed fury and frustration of 100 generations of oppressed and spat upon people. Most especially, they acted for the living generation, witnesses to the final racial catastrophe, the Hitlerian bloodbath in Europe, whose scattered survivors were now ultimate insult, forbid refuge in the land of their ancestors, and the seething spirit of the terror in Palestine was vividly voiced in an almost biblical warning to the British, published in June of 1944 in the Lehigh organ Hazet, after a young member of the organization had been sentenced to hang for shooting a policeman. Quote, This is how you British will walk the streets of Zion from now on, armed to the teeth, prepared for anything and fear in your eyes, fear from every dark corner, in every turn in the road, every sound at night, fear from every Jewish boy, fear day and night because the Jewish youth have become dynamite in this country. You shall walk in burning embers. Our bodies will be the embers and our love of country the fire. No guards, no tanks, no fines, no curfews, no tortures and no hangings, no person, no prison, no detention camp will help you, high commissioners. Your officers, your policemen, we are fed up, we tell you. Your children will become orphans just as you orphaned the children of Israel. Your mothers will lose your sons, just as you made the mothers of Israel mourn for their sons. For every cry of a boy from the top of the burning boat, for every cry of a Hebrew mother when her child embarks on a broken ship in the middle of the sea, for every Jewish tear that is unanswered, we shall answer you. We come in fire. And we are burned. We come in water and we are drowned. We, the remnant, walk in rivers of blood. The blood reaches our necks, our mouths, our eyes, and from the fires and water and blood, trembling arms are raised, voices cry out, and from the mouths and the eyes, and from the trembling arms and fingers, from the water and the fire of blood, from there we are coming up. We are coming. Woe unto you. End quote. Here is the voice of the people speaking with an awesome moral authority conferred by the reeking carnal house of Europe, where 6 million Jews were dying or dead. Reckless the ruler who would defy it. The British were committed, tied to a policy of Arab appeasement by the petroleum pipelines of the Middle East, conscious, drowned in the sea of oil. But they were not insane. They could not, before the eyes of the world, go on hanging Jews. And they got out. Revolution comes in various ways. It came to the French Morocco in a jihad, a holy war brought on by the banishment of the independent Minan Sultan, Mohammed Ben Youssef, and the situation of a puppet, the aged Ben Araf, on the throne of Rabat. Corpses found at dawn in the streets of Casablanca were often those of Muslims who had touched alcohol, forbidden by Islam, and especially sacrilegious during a time of mourning for the true Sultan, in exile on the island of Madagascar. And when smoke arose from the madrasas, it was invariably a burning tobacco shop. Tobacco was forbidden by the same religious austerity and boycotted as a French government monopoly. When a lamb was sacrificed in the courtyard of the Sultan's palace, only the shameless attendant, Ramadan, the holy month, was not observed by the faithful. Another symbol of mourning and protest. Houses went unpainted. Frivolity and ostentation were punished by the swift knives of the Iskital, the People's Party. And for the rest, the resistance was to end the French protectorate and restore the Moroccan independence followed a familiar pattern, exploding bombs, sabotage, and the assassination of Muslim collaborators, native policemen, postmen, cades, subservient to the French, aroused the passions of the people and involved them into a continual conflict with the colonial authorities. Demonstrations in the native quarter grew into riots that overflowed the walls of the Medinas, one after another, from city to city. They swept Morocco during the hot summer of 1955, and in each the French made the same mistake. Panicky police opened fire on unruly crowds, killing a dozen here, a score there, 30 in another place. as the insurrection spread from Casablanca to Marrakesh to Meknes, Fez, and Rabat. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it looks like we're up at the top of the hour. When we come back next week, we'll kind of wrap up our study of the wars of national liberation and their cost. You covered a lot of ground today. I hope you're starting to kind of grasp this picture of insurgency, insurrection, guerrilla warfare, terrorism, the proper application of terror. Indiscriminate terrorism has never been a friend of the subversive movement, of the insurgents. But when it's applied correctly, it's a very, very effective tool. And as always, remember, it's your mind is your primary weapon. And again, we saw today that it wasn't a military struggle. It was a political struggle for independence. Sure, there is the proper application of bullets and bombs, but it's not a military struggle. And because the guerrilla picks the time and the place for the attack, at his own choosing, but the government feels obligated to guard everywhere. And if you try to guard everywhere, you guard nowhere. I'd like to say thank you for tuning in today. We didn't get to any of our border information. I thank you for Liberty Tree Radio. As you know, usually about halfway through the year, we ask people to help contribute for next year's bill. And you can get the information on contacting Liberty Tree Radio on their website. I think that's libertytreeradio.4mg.com. So as always, God bless you. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today. And I'll see you on Thursday and Friday over on The Micro Effect. Thank you. There's a woman on my lap and she's drinking champagne. Have white skin, got assassin's eyes. I'm looking up into the sapphire sky. A well-dressed man waiting on the last plane. Standing in the gallows with my head in the noose. Any minute now, I'm expecting all hell to break loose. Crazy and time strange, locked in tight.